Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Panos Mitrou, the Gas Segment Director at Lloyd's Register, and I'm once again delighted to be moderating this session on LNG and the new energy landscape, covering both shipping but also infrastructure aspects. So, since last year, we have witnessed a spot LNG market practically weakening. We had to live through President Biden's pause and the uncertainty this brought to the sector. We are living through gas asset prices at historic highs, and this refers to both shipping and stationary assets. But it seems we are gradually being pushed against the ropes of growth again. Liquefaction plants are there. Major economies still rely on coal by 50 to 60% for their energy mix in times of transition. And LNG, despite its unprecedented growth, forms part of a methane sector which has not gained the merited share in developing countries, especially around Asia-Pacific. It seems remarkable that the global leader in LNG consumption, which is China today, it uses gas only by 8% of its energy mix. So these developments, along with an aging fleet running out of regulatory compliance, lack of order slots, and the potential shipbuilding capacity to stimulate a greater ambitions in the development of the sector, will all be part of our discussion today. As you can see, we have a lot of ground to cover this morning, as we only have less than 40 minutes now of discussion. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce you to our distinguished panelists. To my right, from Coolco, Richard Tyrrell, the Chief Executive Officer of Coolco, who has served in Coolco since July 2022, over 25 years of energy experience, running a company with great activity in the recent years. Next to him, it's Arthur Regan, CEO of Energus Infrastructure, coming from the infrastructure space, an executive with more than 30 years of experience in the maritime industry and in several investment roles. And next to Arthur is Achilleas Tasiulas, the Chief Financial Officer of Gaslog and Gaslog Partners, with long experience in financing matters. And last but not least, again from the wider space of gas infrastructure, Eric Nyheim, who is the President and CEO of Höegh LNG Holdings, having served in various roles in the industry, and again holding decades of experience. So, gentlemen, it's a great opportunity and benefit, I hope, to have you with us. And I will kick off right away with a more general question on the comments I've made around the market. And what is your view around liquefaction development? And what could be the positive or the less positive scenario in the forthcoming years, especially when it comes to the U.S., but not only U.S. So let me start with the infrastructure gentleman, let's say. So, Eric, would you like to be the first to comment on that?
Yeah, well, I think it's quite certain that over the next few years we're seeing the biggest LNG supply ever coming to market. On the liquefaction side, there's massive investments going into that. So over the next 5 years, we'll see the capacity grow by, you know, more than 40%. The next decade, 65%. And when you look at the projects already under construction and projects already taking FID, we're already talking about, you know, more than 250 BCM. So it is coming. So I think we've got a pretty good predictability on the liquefaction side, and similarly we're seeing the same type of investments going into LNG carriers. So I think we've seen good certainty around the supply side over the next 5 to 10 years.
Thank you, and I'm coming to you, Arthur, and especially on the US side, do you see any surprises we need to be aware of or ready for?
The developments earlier this year, where there's been a pause in the U.S. permitting, was the concern and it was the talking point. But despite that, most of the volumes that have been already permitted, which is almost 50% of the current supply, is definitely going to come. So in regards to the U.S., my own view is that it's just a small pause and that ultimately the supply will come. To us, it feels like the LNG market has finally arrived. I think the world has been awoke to the value of LNG, not only as a low-cost energy source, but as a more environmentally friendly substitute for fossil fuels. So it is the transition fuel of the future for at least decades from now. So we see that as a great opportunity that was part of our investment thesis. And again, Energos Infrastructure, we are predominantly in the distribution, the regasification. We're not really in commodity shipping, although that's a part of our business. We see the great opportunity in distribution to new markets globally, and that will be fostered by increased supply from the U.S., and we look forward to that.
And what about, let's say, our shipping contributors to this panel? What is your view about the future of liquefaction from a service provider point of view, Achilles?
I mean, it sounds like an exciting market to be. So you can tell from the mix of the panel that it is the future. There is focus. LNG is the transition fuel. So it is a market that it makes sense. That it's good to have available vessels. The LNG macros are definitely positive and long-term. Of course, the devil is always on the details in the middle of the years and the delivery of the projects, the timing, the vessels always deliver on time and all that stuff that we all know. But I'm happy that I'm hearing that colleagues validating the macro perspective on the LNG that we have internally as well.
Thank you. And so, Richard, any bearish element to all this? Or?
Well, we've done a whole heap of work on this recently, and I'm not sure what I can share with these guys, but I can share with you that we're up at about 700 million tonnes per annum by 2030, which is up from about 400 today. And there are sensitivities around exactly when those volumes will come. But if you look at the chart, they're on the way and they're going to come faster than anything that we've seen in the past. It might not be until 25, 26, but the ramp up there really is quite considerable, which is good for shipping, or it's a good starting point anyway. But what really makes a difference for shipping is where those cargoes are going, or where they're coming from and where they're going. And I'm sure we're going to get into that, but they're going to go much further, and that requires more ships.
Okay. So let me try to make it a bit more challenging. So evidently, we all see that supply is driven by energy factors, and we will see this growing. But on the shipping side, it seems like we have reached the dead end. Record asset prices, limiting interest rates, technology saturation. We are building more or less the same ship, which is a perfectly and very advanced ship to the previous ones, but we have been building this for something like 10 years now. And at the same time, we are in need of more efficient ships in line with regulatory compliance. And despite all the transition effort, coal is still there, and it's the cheaper form of energy, and at the same time we have the transition pressure leading us outside fossil fuels. So in this situation, how can the LNG sector, especially the LNG shipping sector, cope with so many challenges? Do you see a bright future forward? Are you confident that the sector will achieve to augment, increase in terms of scale, but at the same time remain compliant. So, Richard, I will come to you. What's your view on that?
Yeah, it's a good question, and I think you put it on your email that you sent ahead of this. You wanted to know what the challenges were from an operator's perspective, and I wrote down sublets is number one in the short term, which that's because ships will arrive sometimes in advance of the volumes that they were chartered to lift. And the other one is the regulatory point, which is more of a longer term consideration. And that is, it is a question. If you look at the existing fleet, most of them will be non-compliant by the 2040s. And obviously the older vessels become non-compliant sooner, the newer vessels, you know, a little bit later. Ships have been getting more efficient. Even the new two-stroke vessels are probably about 10% more efficient than the first generation two-stroke vessels. But that's still not going to be enough, because the regulation is not just forcing ships to be more efficient, it's also forcing ships to use more non-fossil fuels. That's the side of the legislation that really trips up the existing fleet. And it's something you've got to be very aware of. Certainly if we're valuing a ship today, we won't value it over the same sort of lifespan as we would have done in the past.
Thank you. And Achilles, what's your view on this difficult situation that is formed?
All good points.
On investment, the fact that we have asset prices.
I would say that,
so
especially at Gaslock, we have been more cautious on the ordering because of all these points that have been raised. It remains to be seen. Indeed, we have reached the point that ship owners need to take very careful decisions. They will always keep on ordering by default. But today, the capex needed for a new building is quite significant, and you will carry this higher capex for a very long time at an elevated debt cost that everybody wants and expects that it will decrease, but it has not happened yet. On the other hand, there are more than 100 older steam vessels on the water today, and if I recall correctly, by 2027, there will be more than 109 steam vessels that they will be more than 25 years old. So the mix of the future fleet, driven by the needs of the market, the regulatory environment, and all that, will define the future decisions. The regulatory environment, especially in Europe, is developing fast, and Europe has the perception that can sort out everything through regulations, and this don't think that it's so easy to happen. But the cost of compliance, potential taxes on carbon and what have you, will define future decisions. So it requires quite careful thinking.
So you are an experienced operator with now quite some track record in the market, and you have all generations of ships in terms of technology. How do you see the fact that many of the long-lived operators, they have ordered ships at 180 million approximately, that today cost 260. And evidently there's an opportunity there, but how easy is for someone that has already invested in something similar at 180 to buy a new ship at 260?
Well, I don't envy them, so that's why we are not doing it in Gaslock. Our focus is to take advantage of the strong market, to reduce our exposure on the older tonnage, and we have been quite successful on that. So it is about the mix of the fleet at the end of the day that also gives you commercial advantages to support your charterers. And we have seen cases in other sectors that older or smaller tonnage being profitable. Mm-hmm. So it's also the mix of your capital structure, your debt risk, how heavy you are on the debt side, your break-evens, that define your profitability, and it's not only the vessel size.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And
may I just add something on the older tonnage?
Yes.
Since we're on older tonnage, I think it's very important to realise the function that the older tonnage has within the fleet. It really acts as the buffer. So at the moment, the market has been fairly flat, but it hasn't been going down. And you know, why is that? That's because the older tonnage is effectively being idled. And once that older tonnage is idled and in due course scrapped, it doesn't come back because it's so expensive to bring it back. You've got to gas up and cool down a vessel. That'll cost maybe $800,000, which if you amortize that over a spot voyage, just doesn't work. And for that reason, these ships are starting to move out of the fleet. Add to that the cost of dry docking, which of course is something you've got to do every 5 years at the cost of between $5 and $10 million, and those vessels will simply not be viable, and they'll fall out of the fleet and help balance things.
And excuse me, Eric.
Yeah, I mean, we're mostly on the regas side, but an observation from the sideline is, of course, that there's now an unprecedented number of ordering happening with 337, or what the latest number is, new vessels coming to market with modern ships. So that's a 50% increase of the current LNG sea fleet. But that seems to be very proportional to the LNG supply coming to market, which is slightly less. But since a lot of the supply will be from the US to Asia, the distances will be a bit longer. So it seems to be proportional, but it's not perfectly in sync. So a lot of the vessels are coming to market earlier than the supply side, which is why we're seeing the rates being a bit slow probably this year and next year. But I think beyond that, we will see the rates coming back up. I think the rates also have to defend the price of the new builds and the cost of the environmental side of this. So I think we'll see a change, you know, starting next year on the rate side.
Eric, coming back to you on that, and this is a question for the whole panel. Do we see any scenario, any hope under which we will see asset prices lower again at, let's say, substantially lower levels? Or you think that 260, more than 300 for an FSRU, et cetera, and this will be the norm from now on?
Well, I mean, most of both the LNGCs, FCUs are built in Korea. So it's really, you know, what are the cost bases in Korea? I mean, steel prices are going a bit up and down, but a large part of it is cost of labor, and it's hard to see that coming down significantly. So I really don't foresee vessel prices coming down significantly. Of course, there will be some changes, but I think fundamentally the cost base will continue to be relatively high.
Okay.
You know, one thing that as an older guy, I recognize in the development of the LNG market is the maturing of the market, just like we've seen, or I've seen in my career, the VLCC market, the Capesize market. It's quite similar. The LNG market started out more or less point to point. Suppliers were also the end users. Everyone was on a 10 or 20 year charter. That's all changed now. Like Richard had mentioned, it depends on where the cargo is going and where it comes from. There has been the development of a real trading environment, and this is the natural evolution of a maturing market. Within that, I think ship owners see the opportunity, they see the ton miles developing, so they order ships. But the difference in this case is it hasn't really been speculative. They've been against good, solid contract names for 10 or more years, so that's healthy. So Richard mentioned that one of the obstacles would be the potential for relet, but this also is just a natural evolution of a market. And what we see on the regasification side is that there will be cargoes going to markets that don't even exist today. So there's plenty of growth that still is yet to come, and in some cases they're in markets that don't exist today. So how many vessels that will be needed remains in question. I think the technological development, where maybe a third of the fleet will eventually work itself out of the market, those ship owners generally have been well compensated during their 20-plus years of operating the vessel, so there isn't a lot of stress there, which is why they hang around. But naturally, I think the markets will take care of that. So we don't see, at least from a carrier or the overall LNG market, reason to be overly concerned, despite the fact that there's a high order book. Frankly, I think it's the natural evolution of the cycles of a maturing market. The shipyards that have really benefited from the order book in the last 5 years, that will eventually also slow down. We do see gaps from 2028 and beyond, which, yes, of course, that's more than 4 years. So that's very comfortable for the shipyards. But China is beginning to expand their shipyards in building LNG carriers because it's a better margin fabrication for them. Eventually, I think, just like we've seen in the VLCC market and the Capesize market, there will be too many builders of these vessels, so the prices probably will come down. But hopefully that's concurrent with ton-mile expansion, and the market will be, again, more mature. And our business model is on the distribution side, so we just see a very positive outlook going forward.
Arthur, I will definitely agree with you that we need greater supply and shipbuilding capacity so that the market can benefit and absorb shocks of supply. In this space, Chinese effort in the last few years has been remarkable, and we see now a substantial part of the order book coming from China. But Richard, do you have any thoughts on how we could lower any other thoughts on how we could lower that asset price to something more reasonable?
I agree that it's not coming down very much. And of course, as the order book starts to shrink, which it will do as deliveries hit the water, there may be a little bit of more scope for owners to negotiate. But we're talking $5 or $10 million here, so we're not talking about the price coming down to 190 again. And then if you combine that with the cost of financing, you need pretty high rates. But the good news is that the customers are making good money still on shipping LNG, and those rates are still relatively low relative to the margin on the molecules.
Great, thank you. And Achilles, do you feel that perhaps...
Yeah, just to agree with the fact that the more the shipping market on the LNG or the LNG in general is commoditized, we will see fluctuations on the price. On the other hand, the price is a function of interest rates, steel price, inflation, costs, whatever, labor. So this, I don't see this going down. But the more increase in the competition in shipyard slots availabilities, how other sectors are performing, how aggressively they are building, how many slots are allocated to LNG and all that stuff will fluctuate the new building price. What can heavily affect the vessel values is if there is a disruption in all this nice picture that we project, and there you can have what we usually call distress price, but I don't expect this to happen, but a situation like that with a kind of mismatch can normalize the markets in general.
Okay, that's an interesting point. Coming now into the infrastructure point of view, and evidently we have heard about all this liquefaction and shipping orders coming in the water, and we will need to channel all this extra LNG to the markets, and in this case we will need more entry points to the markets, greater distribution of that LNG, especially to Asian developing countries, which means we will need more stationary assets. And do you, under these circumstances, do you foresee that the development and the construction of these units will come from the new construction space, or do you foresee that the aging fleet and aging assets could be used, repurposed for stationary employment? So Arthur, what's your take on that?
It would be optimistic to say both, because I do think that's true, but I think it will be disproportional towards the utilization of the older steam-powered vessels that are near their end of their life. But there will also be some new buildings for the regasification and the distribution side. The answer to that is generally in these developing countries, they don't have the existing land-based infrastructure. They don't want to put the capital forward to build a permanent regasification facility on their in their country. So what we offer is a much more flexible sort of a plug-and-play solution where we have the regasification equipment on board our LNG storage vessels. So it can provide that service, and it's really an engineering solution. It's not just an asset, it's also an engineering solution to bring power to a developing market. And that is usually not a bigger, better, super modern vessel, because that would be much more expensive and probably too much capacity for a developing nation. So they start small generally, and that's our hope, that they might be able to utilize one of the vessels that would otherwise be near its end of life, smaller capacity, less sophisticated, but we can do a conversion where we can add appropriate technology and bring it in a plug-and-play fashion to a developing country and start their usage of LNG in that, not only for security purposes, where many countries now are thinking about energy security and taking care of their own needs rather than relying on others, because you never know when someone might not be friendly, and then also because there's so much focus on energy diversification. I used the word transition, but I would prefer diversification, because it's likely to be just a piece of the pie. It won't be 100% conversion. And in that case, I think the older vessels are much more suited. So it's a little customer focused. The developed nations, like in Europe in some cases, Poland, Singapore, that already have mature power infrastructure, they can take the larger size new buildings, so that's an appropriate selection there. But that wouldn't be so in a much, much smaller developing country. Would be too much. So I think it's a little bit of both, but I would say the majority will be conversions and using older tonnage.
Thank you, Arthur. And I definitely note that plug and play element. Talking to many authorities around the world in need of development of infrastructure, I think this is the kind of service solution that we are in need of. And Eric, coming to you on the same grounds.
Yeah, so I think as we discussed, we're seeing massive investments going into liquefaction, same on the LNGC side, but we're not quite seeing the same picture on the regas side. And we do think that will have to grow in a proportional way over time. There's certainly a lag that needs to be catched up. I hear people saying there's plenty of regas capacity available, but when you look at where the main capacities are, it's in the old giants, it's Japan, it's Korea, it's Spain, where growth is not going to happen. So I think a lot of the growth coming to market now will be, you know, some countries in Europe and then South Asia and Southeast Asia. And for many of those markets, I think the FSRUs will be very well suited. They can be quickly deployed, they're very flexible and suited for smaller markets. So we do see a case for growth on the FSRU side. I agree it will be a combination of new builds and conversions. At the moment, there's only a couple of firm new builds, there's only a couple of conversions, so probably there will be more coming. On conversions, an FSRU typically will have to be able to receive a full load of cargo. A lot of the steamers which are available typically are smaller sizes, 145,000 or below. They will only be suited for special markets like South America, Africa, etc. So for main markets in Europe, Asia, you will need full capacity FSRUs, and then you're talking 160,000, 180,000 cubes, which means a bit more modern LNGCs for conversions. I think that the prices are probably comparable. Of course, new builds now, you know, take 4 or 5 years to market, while conversions can be done probably in a couple of years. So right now, that seems to be the most attractive way of creating capacity.
Thank you. You can do us all a favor and use two steamers instead of one to solve that capacity compatibility issue.
Can I add a point?
Yeah, please.
This can only be good for the carriers because the carriers will compete with less FSRUs, for example, or the more we are developing the land demand, the more carriers we need. The other example that I have in mind is that because of the energy security from the situation in Europe, we have been able to fix for a longer period all the tonnage in state-owned entities in Singapore, in Greece, carriers to be used as floating storage units. So we see a different use on the assets. Conversions, it's a bit complicated. You need long lead items. It's expensive. We have done it for our project in Greece. It's doable, but it cannot really be the only driver of supporting this business.
Yes. But it's remarkable that you have already a track record on this with at least one unit and looking forward for more. Richard, I will come to you on a different case. We see now quite some trouble with many developments across the world on trade routes. So we have a huge expansion of U.S. liquefaction. We will see perhaps 40 shipments in the forthcoming future. Many of these ships will be heading to China. We have an issue with Panama, and we don't see this being resolved and these ships having, especially noting how many segments of ships will use Panama in the future. So what is your projection about the future of trade routes and ton miles, and whether we are missing a bit there that has not been in place, and it's also developing along with the liquefaction development and the growth of supply. So could we see that 1 million tons per annum of a ship will decrease in the future due to longer routes? And what's your view on what could happen there?
Sure. I think the routes are going to be longer in the future, and that's going to mean you need more ships per million tons per annum. I think you said it the other way around, but if it was one, then I think in terms of numbers of ships per millions of tons per annum, it's going to be up at 1.4 by the time this is played out. And the reason for that is that the volumes are all coming from the US. It's going to be approximately 40% of volumes by 2030 will be from the US. And some of them will go to Europe, but Europe's kind of full. And you've seen in the last year or so that Europe's actually been scaling back its demand, and we've seen volumes go east, and of course that means going further. And not only that, because of the Panama Canal issues, it's meant recently going via the Cape of Good Hope, which is a longer passage. So, you know, in future, the trend for cargoes to go east, that I think is clear. When it comes to whether cargoes will continue to go via the Cape of Good Hope or Panama, and of course there'll be some that go via Panama. I think in the short term, these companies have all set their ADPs, which are their basically lifting schedules, to go via the Cape of Good Hope, and that's what they'll do. Going forward, the one area which I think is often underappreciated, but where customers get real value from shipping, is in having optionality. And even if they can go through Panama, I think most of them will want to keep the options open to go the other way, because no one knows what's going to happen in Panama. Maybe it doesn't rain again for another season and they have the same issues again, and people aren't going to want to be left short of shipping under that scenario.
Thank you. Yep. And Achillea?
Yeah, I mean, all these are good points. At the end of the day, it's a mix of the LNG price, the arbitrage to be open, the demand from Asia that it has been relatively weak compared to the demand from Europe that is now full, as it was said. The wild card is China in terms of demand in Asia. The other wild card that I have been reading lately is the electrification, that it's supposed to create an enormous need for energy demand, and we see LNG filling this gap. So driven by the data centers, artificial intelligence and all that. So there are quite a few wildcards on the table that will play a significant role. That's why I started my intro, that it's an exciting industry and moment to be in.
Okay, thank you. And a final one, very quick one, short, to all of you, I would like to ask, do you see size changing in this sector? We know the workhorse is 174, but we have seen 180s, 200s, now 270s again, Q-maxes. Do you think that we could see both infrastructure as well as ships being increased in size to battle the unit freight cost factor or even emissions factors? What's your quick one word on that? Richard.
Yeah, happy to go first on that one. I originally was very focused on unit freight cost, and of course that makes you think that the bigger's better. But when you really get into the market, I think there's a lot of the new markets that really can't take ships of that kind of size. And it's partly because their infrastructure, if it's an FSIU, is not scaled to take larger ships. But in many cases, it's just simply that they aren't that big a market, and they don't need such a lot of LNG in one delivery. So I think rather than ships getting bigger, and of course there's all sorts of other constraints around gas sales agreements, and they tell the shippers what they can ship and limit things, I think if anything, the trends are not going to be around unit freight cost. They're going to be more around how to make ships more efficient, and that could be anything from obviously all the kind of initiatives that various companies and the industry has in place, through to just simply steaming slower, which of course is the other way to reduce emissions and deliver the commodity with less CO2.
Arthur?
Going back to the comment about the maturing of the LNG market and using other commodities as a reference point, I think it's natural that the economy of scale trial and error is pursued, and that's exactly what's going on with LNG. It's obvious to say the more volume, the lower unit freight costs, the better it is for everyone. However, the markets themselves, like we've seen the other commodities, they do like to see a sweet spot. So the volumes become something that's tradable, that grows the market because it's a dependable volume. The distribution system organizes itself around that volume, so it becomes a little bit of just the way things are. We've seen that in all the other commodity markets. So I do think it will continue where the expansion is tried. We've seen quite a lot of the 200s and 220s now. More 260s, you know, that is, as Richard was saying, that's a very big volume to swallow. So I personally think less of that, and we're circling between the 180 and the 200, 220, and that's probably where the growth comes because that's what the market can absorb.
Achilles.
For the moment, larger sizes seems to be project specific. So we don't see the technology to develop so fast and so rapidly that it will create a massive advantage. So it's not just size. So the sweet spot today is below 200, and I believe it will stay there for the moment at least.
Eric?
Well, from an FSIU standpoint, I think we'll see small sizes in certain markets. We'll see high capacity FSUs, 160,000 to 180,000 in main markets. Beyond that, I think there will be certain projects where you will see higher capacity FSUs, but mostly the Q-Flexes, Q-Maxes, bigger sizes, will be more special trades directly from, say, Qatar to big land-based facilities. So I don't really see that impacting hugely the FSU side, you know, except for certain special projects. I think that would be the FSU perspective on it.
Okay, thank you. So summing up, and thank you for all your contribution and insightful input, I would like to underline some quick points. Richard referenced to the aging fleet and 2040 as being, let's say, the horizon of the existing fleet compliance. Achilles mentioning financing conditions and also the aspects of interest rates and these matters that could substantially change the landscape in the forthcoming years. I will also underline Eric's point on regas capacity, and despite the available volume, the need for greater distribution and more entry points with flexible solutions. And Arthur, I will definitely echo what you mentioned about plug and play technology solutions and how this could contribute to a quick, fast uptake. With this, and noting time constraints and that we're out of time, I would like to thank our panelists for the very interesting and intriguing insights, and I would kindly ask you to give them a big round of applause.